might run on a bit. But if they find out what happened to the teenagers, then it'll be worth it, yes? He bites into his sandwich and leans up against the kitchen counter, his legs crossed at the ankle, his gaze fixed hard on the floor at his feet. She watches him wipe a smudge of butter from the corner of his mouth, hears his jaw grinding down on his food. I'm sorry, she says. He lifts his gaze from the floor and his eyes meet hers and his face relaxes. He smiles at her.
Don't be, he says. It's not your fault. And you're right. If they find out what happened to those teenagers, you'll have done a good thing. I just wish you'd involved me, that's all. Remember, we're a team now. You and me, we work together. Yes?
She smiles, grateful for the softening of his mood. Yes, she says. I know that. I love you. He gazes at her for a moment and then, after a beat, says,
I love you too.
Let me know, she says a moment later as he places his plate in the dishwasher and collects his lanyard. What happens with the teaching assistant? With Liam, won't you? Sophie spends the afternoon wandering around campus, trying to pick up developments via osmosis. The school grounds manager and Carrie-Anne Mulligan are overseeing the search of the woods. Students going between lessons slow down as they glimpse the activity. She feels the bubble of her pulse as the drama ripples through the grounds. She thinks of her hand on the rough wood of the trowel from the Jacques' greenhouse, her fingers scrabbling in the soil, the feeling of dread that she might be about to find something gruesome. She remembers how alone she was then, how small a moment it was in the scheme of her life, and how weird it is that that tiny, lonely moment has somehow blown up into this. Detectives, dogs, a potential media circus. At around 3 o'clock, Sophie finally feels hungry, decides she doesn't like the look of any of the healthy stuff in their fridge, and heads to the vending machine outside the school refectory. She finds some coins in the bottom of her purse and slots them in, presses the buttons that correlate to the salt and vinegar crisps and the Dairy Milk bar, which is all she can face, collects them, and walks to the cloisters at the back of the hall. Here she sits on the same bench where she'd sat on the evening of the registration day party, looking at Liam Bailey's feet. The sun appears suddenly from behind a cloud, and she closes her eyes against the rays. When she opens them, Liam is standing in front of her. She jumps.
Sorry,
he said.
I thought you'd seen me coming.
She laughs to hide her embarrassment at being caught with her eyes closed in public. No, it's fine. How are you? He shrugs and says,
Bit wrung out. Just had the third degree from the cops. They seem to think that ring being buried there is something to do with me.
He shakes his head in bafflement. Sophie moves up the bench and gestures to him to sit down. He looks up at the windows of the college and then back to her.
I should go back to class, really. I've already missed a whole lesson.
Just quickly, what were they asking you about? She asks.
Just, you know, more of the same. About the night those kids went missing. Who was there? What time did I leave? What did I see? What didn't I see? The same questions I answered 100 times after it happened. They showed me the ring. Asked if I'd ever seen it before. I told them you'd show me the photo of it.
Sophie starts.
You did?
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to answer all their questions 100% truthfully. And when they said, have you ever seen this ring before? I had to tell them that I had. I mean, it's okay, they didn't seem to make anything of it. And anyway, hopefully that's that. Hopefully they won't be back asking me any more questions. Because I can tell you for nothing, they'd be totally wasting their time.
He puffs his cheeks and then exhales. Well, he says, I really should get back to it.
Enjoy your lunch, he says, eyeing her crisps and chocolate bar. Liam, she says quickly, before you go, the Jacques family, did you ever think it might have been them? You know, that they might have had something to do with those kids' disappearance?
Of course I thought that, he replies. It's the only theory that makes any sense. But why would they have wanted to hurt them? And how did they get away with it? And the ring, what about the ring? Who would have put it there and why?
He shakes his head slowly. I really need to get on now, he says. But maybe we could meet up another time.
Yes, she says. Yes, please.
He tips his head at her, throws her a smile and heads away. But then he turns back and he says,
Oh, I meant to say, I ordered your books. The whole series. They arrived this morning. I started reading the first one straight away.
That's so lovely of you. You really didn't have to.
I know, he says. But I wanted to.
By the time Sean gets home from work at 8 o'clock that night, the police have gone and the school feels restored to equilibrium. The sun has already set. The summery day turned instantly to autumn. And Sophie is on her knees in the spare bedroom, finally unpacking some of the movers' boxes, almost, she suspects, as a silent apology to Sean for making his first few days in his new job more stressful than they needed to be. His children are coming at the weekend, and it's time to make the place look like a home for them. He calls up the stairs to her, and she calls back.
In the kids' bedroom. I'll be down in a minute.
But she hears his steps coming up the stairs, and then he's there. He sees that she has dressed the beds in fresh sheets, the same bedding that had adorned their beds in his spare bedroom in Lewisham. He sees that she has hung the prints on the wall, that she has folded towels onto the feet of the beds, plugged in bedside lamps and thrown down sheepskin rugs. His demeanour softens at the sight of it.
Oh God, Soph, thank you so much. This has been hanging over my head. I was going to do it. I don't know when I was going to do it. I'm so grateful to you, really. You really didn't need to.
It's nothing, she says. I'm all over the place right now and can't get into work, so it's good to have something mindless to focus on.
She rises to her feet and surveys the room. It looks lovely.
Shall we go to the pub?
He says, pulling her to him. For dinner. She thinks of the crisps and chocolate she had for lunch and realises that she would love a proper meal. A glass of wine. Some time away from this place, just her and Sean.
Give me a minute, she says. I'll put something warmer on.
This is where they were, she says to Sean as they settle themselves at a table in the small lounge area just to the left of the bar.
Zach and Tallulah, they were in here with the kids from Maypole House. They all ended up back at a girl's house just outside the village. Liam Bailey was with them, Carrie Ann's daughter too.
Sean nods. I'm starting to get the full picture. It's all a bit unsettling.
Have you spoken to Peter Doody about it?
Yeah, I called him earlier when the police were here. He was very dismissive, very blasé. It's clearly not a topic he wants to give any oxygen to.
But he was involved with the school at the time. Did he know about the connection?
Yes, was very much part of it at the time. He dealt with the press, the PR side of things, kept the parents happy. I mean, really, it's nothing to do with the school, or our children, or their families. The students involved had already left the school by the time the couple disappeared, and Liam and Lexi had returned to the school that night way before anything untoward happened. The woods aren't technically school property, and as far as Peter's concerned, it's nothing to do with us. And he'd like it to stay that way.
And what about the previous head, Jacinta... What's her name? Was she here when this was all going on?
Yes, she was right in the thick of it. It was a nightmare by all accounts.
A waiter appears then. It's the same guy who had been behind the bar with Kim when Sophie came in earlier in the week for a coffee. He smiles a brilliant white smile and says,
Hi guys, how are you both doing tonight?
Sophie returns his smile and says, We're great, thank you. How are you?
Knackered, he replies. They work me like a dog in here.
He rolls his eyes.
Have you had a chance to look at the menu yet?
No, they both reply apologetically.
Could we order some wine?
Sean asks.
Absolutely, and who would blame you? The day it's been today, police all over the place, again.
Oh, says Sophie. Were they in here?
Yes.
You know those kids who disappeared from the village last summer? Looks like it's all been raked up again. On the plus side, the hot detective is back.
He flashes his white teeth at them again. Sorry, anyway, wine, you say?
They order the wine and then wait until the waiter is back behind the bar before Sean looks at Sophie and says,
Well, there you go. The cat is well and truly amongst the pigeons. What would Tiger and Susie do?
She smiles at Sean's joke and shrugs. But inside, she's thinking, she knows what Tiger and Susie would do. They would talk to the woman who was running the school when Zack and Tallulah disappeared. They would talk to Jacinta Croft.
Chapter 30, February 2017.
Scarlett messages Tallulah later that night. The phone chirrups in her hand as she sits next to Zack on the sofa, and she feels his eyes search out the screen of her phone. She switches it off quickly when she sees Scarlett's name.
Who was that?
No one, she says. Just Chloe.
What does Chloe want?
I don't know. Probably just wants to talk shit about people.
She feels him bristling with questions he wants to ask. But her mum is there, and Zack is always sweetness and light when her mum is around. She has to wait 20 minutes for Zack to leave the room before she can check the message. She puts the phone on the sofa and switches it on there so that she can easily tuck it out of sight if Zack comes back.
Yo, T from the B. Can you come round after college on Friday? Mum's out of town for the night. You could sleep over, maybe.
She switches it off, feeling her heart racing beneath her ribs. Scarlett believes Tallulah to be your average 18-year-old girl, the type who can come and go at her own pace, the kind with no commitments. And now Tallulah thinks of this other version of herself, the one with no commitments. And she imagines that other Tallulah thinking, Well, I don't have college the next day. I could go over to Scarlett's. We could have a few drinks, stay up late, eat cereal with hangovers the next morning in her big glossy kitchen. Suddenly, she wants this other Tallulah's life more than anything in the world. She turns her head to the door of the living room, checking for Zack, but there's no sign of him. So she taps the screen of her phone as quickly as she can. Maybe, yeah, I'll see what I can do. For the rest of that week, Tallulah builds a story about Chloe. Chloe, she tells her mother, is being bullied by a group of kids from college. Chloe can't tell her mother what's happening because Chloe's mother would just make things worse. Chloe is feeling suicidal. Chloe has been talking about slitting her wrists. Her mother tells her that she really should tell someone, someone at the college maybe. Tallulah says no. Chloe would definitely not want her to talk to the college, that she doesn't want anyone to talk to the college. And then at about 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, Tallulah tells her mother that Chloe has just called and that she is in crisis and that she needs her and that she is going to her house.
Can you look after Noah? She asks her mum. Just until Zack gets back from work. Is that okay?
Her mother nods fervently.
Of course, yes, of course. But please stay in touch. Let me know if you need me to do anything. Call me, please, if it looks like she's going to do anything stupid.
She touches Tallulah's cheek and says,
You're such a kind person, such a good friend. I'm so proud of you.
Tallulah feels so guilty she almost wants to throw up. She leaves before she betrays herself in any way. Leaves without even saying goodbye to Noah. She passes Chloe's cottage on the way out of the village and stops just for a moment, just in case someone is watching, just so they could say, Oh yes, I saw Tallulah outside Chloe's house. In the pockets of her jacket are a spare pair of underwear, a toothbrush, and her debit card. She waits for a minute or two, and then carries on cycling. Zack will be on the bus, heading back along this road on his way home from work in just over an hour, so she keeps her hood up, and sticks to the shadows and the pavements where they veer off the edge of the road between avenues of trees. She turns off the main road with a sigh of relief. Then she cycles to the gates of Dark Place and messages Scarlett. I'm here, she types. I'm outside.
You look pretty,
says Scarlett, wheeling her bike away for her and tucking it out of sight behind the garage.
No, Tallulah replies.
I do not look pretty. I literally came straight here and haven't even looked in a mirror.
Well, I have two good eyes in my head, and they both see pretty.
Tallulah smiles and follows Scarlett into the house. Toby greets them in the hallway and joins them in the seating area in the big kitchen extension.
How was college? Asks Scarlett.
I didn't go today. I only go 3 times a week.
Oh, says Scarlett. How come?
Just the way the course works, Tallulah replies, not mentioning that she'd worked closely with the course director to construct a timetable that fitted around her other role as a parent.
So you study at home the rest of the time?
Yeah.
That's cool, Scarlett replies. Do you have your own room?
Yeah,
she says again. Technically, it's not a lie. Technically, it is her own room. She just happens to be sharing it with her boyfriend and an 8-month-old baby.
What's your house like?
It's, I don't know, it's just like a house, you know. A door, some windows, a staircase, some rooms. It's not like...
She spreads her arm in an arc across the extraordinary glass structure they're sitting within.
Yeah, well, not much is like this place, I guess.
What was it like, your old house in Guernsey?
Oh, you know, pretty spectacular too. Right on a cliff's edge, overlooking the sea. We still own it.
Wow, says Tallulah, shaking her head slowly at the concept of owning not one, but 2 properties as incredible as this.
Plus there's my dad's apartment in Bloomsbury.
He has an apartment in London.
Yeah, a penthouse with views over the British Museum. It's really cool.
Tallulah shakes her head again.
What's it like to be so rich?
She asks. Scarlett smiles and rises to her feet.
It's nice, I suppose. But, you know, it would also be nice to have a father who wants to live with you and a mother who likes you and a brother who doesn't always have something better to be doing.
It would be nice just to be a normal family, like the ones on Gogglebox, you know.
She points at the drinks cabinet behind her and says,
Rum, or is it too early?
Tallulah looks at the time on the oversized clock hanging on the wall beside her. It's 5 o'clock. Zach will be leaving work now. In about 45 minutes or thereabouts, he'll get home and Tallulah's mum will explain to him where Tallulah is and he will try calling her and she will have to ignore his calls and then send him a lie in a text message. She doesn't want to be drunk then. She needs to keep a clear head.
6 o'clock would be better, she says.
Scarlett smiles.
You,
she says, turning away from the drinks cabinet,
are a good influence. I had a feeling you might be.
Cup of tea? Cup of tea would be lovely.
The sky is starting to darken. Tallulah sees it growing bruises across the top of the trees behind the house, feels the night start to close down her options.
Will you stay over? Asks Scarlett, as if reading her thoughts.
I don't know yet. Maybe.
Maybe,
she responds teasingly.
Yes, maybe.
Tallulah smiles and realizes she's doing something she's never done before in her life. She's flirting. She wonders at this for a moment as she stares at the outline of Scarlett's body, the jutting angles of it, the long stretch of off-white wrist visible below the turned-up cuff of her scruffy sweatshirt. The tight lines of cartilage and bone pressing at the skin. She looks at the bobbles on Scarlett's sports socks, the patches of dog hair on the knees of her joggers. She looks at the way her hair is hanging halfway out of a toweling scrunchie. She looks at the large spot on her jawline and notes that her lips look dry and she needs to put some balm on them. She looks at a girl who is too thin and too scruffy and might not have had a shower this morning and maybe not even this week. She sees a girl who drinks rum when she's alone and cuts off friendships when they threaten to overwhelm her and boyfriends when they're too good for her. She sees a girl who's on the edge of oblivion, maybe looking for something to hold on to. And she knows, somehow, that that thing is her.
Well, says Scarlett, topping up the kettle from the tap. I'll have to see what I can do to persuade you then.
Where's your mum?
Date night with Dad in London. She drops in on him unannounced whenever she suspects there might be someone hanging around, you know.
You mean having an affair?
Yes, that sort of thing.
And is he?
Having an affair?
She shrugs. Fuck knows, probably. He's rich and old. Rich old men get mega muff.
She sniffs and puts the kettle back on its base.
Whatever, I don't care. It's just old people stuff.
They sit with their mugs of tea, and Scarlett puts a playlist through the Sonos speaker system, and they chat for a while about their lives, their parents, their plans. At some point, it gets entirely dark, and Tallulah is quietly surprised when her phone buzzes. She turns it over, glances at the screen, sees Zach's name, locks the screen, turns the phone over.
Who was that?
No one, she replies.
A few seconds later, her phone buzzes again. This time she picks it up and says,
Sorry, I should probably get this.
Zach's message says, Chloe isn't your problem. Tell her to call the Samaritans. I need you. Noah needs you. She pauses for a moment before replying. I'll be here as long as it takes. Might stay the night. Please don't message me again. Her phone starts to ring the moment she locks the screen again. She declines the call and puts the phone on silent. Adrenaline pumps through her sickeningly. She breathes in hard to bring her heart back to normal.
Trouble?
Scarlett asks.
No,
she replies.
It's nothing.
She glances up at the huge clock on the wall again. It says 5:51.
1 o'clock,
she says, tipping an eyebrow at Scarlett.
Hell yeah,
says Scarlett, leaping to her feet and heading to the cabinet.
Hell yeah.
Tallulah wakes the following day in the custard yellow light of the early morning sun, filtered through thick cream curtains. Her phone tells her that it is 7:15. On the pillow to her left is one of Scarlett's feet. Soft white skin, perfect toenails painted black, done by a professional, belying the rough and ready image she tries so hard to portray. Tallulah stares at the toenails, imagines her at the fancy nail place near Manton Station with the pink walls and the glittery cushions, her phone in her hand, her feet extended in a leather chair towards a masked girl from Vietnam. Tallulah has never had a manicure or a pedicure. She would feel too embarrassed. Her hangover starts to leak into her system as she pulls herself up to sitting. She checks the messages on her phone. 13 from Zach. She doesn't bother reading them. One from her mum, sent at 2 a.m. Just checking in. Hope all is okay with Chloe. Zach told me you were sleeping over. All good with Noah. Love you, Mum. She slowly unpeels herself from the heavy down of Scarlett's duvet and slides off her huge king-size bed, her feet landing on soft sheepskin. Scarlett's head is buried under the bottom end of the duvet, just a small tuft of blue hair visible. A memory blasts through Tallulah's head, her fingers in that mop of blue, her lips on those lips. Scarlett's hand. She shakes her head hard. Really hard. No, she thinks. No, no, no. That hadn't happened. Her mind is playing tricks on her. She glances at Scarlett again, at the shape of her, upside down under the duvet. Why is she upside down? Then she remembers. She remembers pushing Scarlett's hand away last night, pulling away from her lips, taking her hand from her hair, saying the words,
No, that's not who I am.
Scarlett had pulled back and looked her hard in the eye and said,
Well then, who the hell are you, Tallulah from the bus?
And Tallulah had shaken her head and said,
I'm just me.
Scarlett had put a finger against her narrow lips, run it across the place where Tallulah's own lips had just rested, sighed and said,
Oh well, there you go. Timing is everything.
Tallulah didn't know what she'd meant by that, but she knew that she'd asked Scarlett to call her a taxi, that she'd wanted to go home, and that Scarlett had said,
Don't be stupid. It's 2 in the morning. Stay.
She'd pressed her hand against her heart and said,
We'll sleep top to toe, okay?
Now Tallulah sighs and tiptoes from the room, picking up her jeans and her phone. In the white marble bathroom, she messages her mum. Just woken up. All good. I'll be home in half an hour. How's Noah? Her mother replies immediately. He's fine, just had his breakfast. No rush, stay as long as you need to stay. Come back when you're ready. She replies with 3 love heart emojis in a row, and then with a heavy heart, she opens Zach's messages. This is bullshit. You don't have time for me, but you have time for her. Noah is crying for you. Call yourself a mum. You don't get to do this. Fuck's sake, fucking get home, I'm serious. What the fuck are you playing at? Fuck you, Tallulah. Fuck you. In between are brief voice recordings of Noah crying. Behind the sound of her son's tears are the sounds of Zach soothing him in whispers. It's okay, little man. It's okay. Mum's with someone she cares about more than you. But don't you worry, little man. Dad's here for you. And Dad loves you. Don't you ever forget that. She glances up at the sound of a creaking floorboard outside the bathroom and quickly locks her phone.
Lula?
Yeah?
You okay?
I'm good, just on the toilet.
Thought I heard a baby crying.
Weird, Tallulah says quietly. There's a beat of silence and she hears the floorboard creaking again. Then Scarlett says,
yeah, weird.
They eat their breakfast together, just as Tallulah had imagined they would. Bare legs, oversized t-shirts, smudged eyeliner, thick breath. The sky outside is dirty grey, full of snow about to fall. The big glass box at the back of the house feels chilly. Scarlett throws her a fake fur throw when she sees her shivering. This is where Scarlett had kissed her the night before. Right here. Tallulah puts a hand out to touch the square of leather she'd been sitting on when Scarlett had slid towards her last night, put a hand to her face and said,
don't you know how beautiful you are?
She remembers the shiver of energy that had passed through her as she realised what was happening.
I'm not,
she'd said quietly, the words almost a gasp.
Not what?
She didn't reply because she couldn't. She didn't know what she was. All she knew was that when she was with Scarlett, she felt as though she could be anyone she wanted to be. Now Scarlett smiles at her indulgently.
God,
she says,
you are such a cutie.
Tallulah smiles and says,
you're so weird.
Then she drops her smile and says,
have you ever, I mean, are you like gay?
Labels, says Scarlett, faux theatrically. Boring, idiotic labels.
Well then, am I the first girl?
Yes, you are the first girl. Oh,
she says, suddenly putting her hand to her cheek. Apart from all the other girls.
Really?
Yes, really. But you're the first girl for a long time. A long, long time.
Tallulah's phone buzzes. She looks at it vaguely. It's another message from Zach. What the fuck, Tallulah? It buzzes again. This time it's a photo. It's Noah. Zach's face is pressed close to his and he looks angry. For a moment, Tallulah feels scared. Zach looks like he could hurt Noah. She gets to her feet and then sits down again. No, she thinks. No. Zach would never hurt Noah. Never. He's just using Noah to control her.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm just... my boyfriend.
Is he giving you grief?
Yeah, a bit.
Can't cope with you having your own life away from him.
That kind of thing.
Scarlett rolls her eyes.
Men,
she says.
They're such losers.
She leans forward towards Tallulah and fixes her with her pale grey eyes.
Whatever you do, she says, don't let him play you, okay? Stick to your guns. Stay strong.
Tallulah nods. She'd already decided that that was what she would do.
You go to him now and he's won. And the next time, it'll be just that bit easier for him to control you, yeah?
She nods again. Scarlett leans back again.
Good girl,
she says.
Good girl.
And as she says these words, Tallulah feels something bubble up inside her. Something hot and liquid and raw and red, and it rushes from her groin through her heart to her limbs and she jumps to her feet, and she strides towards Scarlet, and she straddles her with her bare legs against hers, and she kisses her.
Chapter 31, September 2018.
The following morning, Sophie calls her hairdresser in Deptford and makes an appointment for later that day.
"I'm going into London today," she tells Sean,
"to get my hair done for the Denmark trip."
"Denmark trip?"
"Yes, I told you, remember? Next Monday. It's only for one night."
He nods distractedly. "Can you not use the hairdressers in the village?"
"No," she says, "definitely not. And besides, I'd like to go to London. I might meet someone for lunch, make a day of it."
He nods again. "That's nice."
She suspects that if she asks him again in 30 minutes to tell her what she just told him, he will have no idea.
"What's going on with the police today?"
she asks, watching him thread his tie through the back of his shirt collar.
"Are they coming back?"
"No idea. Guess I'll find out once I get to my desk."
He flattens his collar down against the loop of his tie and straightens it in the mirror. It had thrilled her at first, the sight of Sean in a suit and tie, the flecks of grey in his chest hair, the smart leather shoes. Small people calling him Daddy. She'd go for drinks with her friends and say, "It's so nice to finally be with a grown-up. You know, a real man." And they'd nod enthusiastically and tell her how lucky she was. But now that reassuring maturity has started to solidify into something else, into a kind of rigidness. The tie seems to sit straighter and tighter. His jawline is harder. His hugs are briefer, almost abrupt. She approaches him and kisses him on the cheek. He looks at her in surprise.
"We'll have a lovely weekend," she says. "With the kids, yes?"
"I hope so," he says. "I really hope so."
Jacinta Croft, the previous head teacher at Maypole House, had been easy to find. She's now the head of a large private girls' school in Pimlico. Her face smiled out at Sophie from the screen of her laptop, at the top of a press release about her new position. An ageless blonde in a cream blouse with a gold chain around her neck. Sophie leaves her hair appointment at midday, takes the train from Deptford to London Bridge, and then gets on the tube. The warm thrum of the London Underground envelops her, the familiar smell of oiled metal and recycled breath, the copies of Metro strewn over the seats, the gentle rocking back and forth. She closes her eyes and breathes it in. At Pimlico, she follows the directions on Google Maps to Jacinta's school. It's housed in a Jacobean building with curved mirror image steps that meet up at the front door. She hasn't written to Jacinta. She knows that an email would have gone through an assistant or a secretary, and she'd have received a polite response suggesting it might be best to leave the case in the hands of the police. Instead, she rings the bell and tells the young woman on the desk inside that she wants to pick up a prospectus. Inside, she engages the young woman in a very detailed conversation about her stepdaughter, Pixie, who's coming to London next month from New York to live with her and her father. Pixie is very bright, very creative, excellent at languages, wants to be a lawyer. She asks the young woman lots of questions about the school and then asks her about the new head teacher, and the young woman's face lights up and she says that Jacinta is an incredible woman. She's totally transformed the place. All the girls love her. She's inspiring and nurturing. And Sophie says, "Gosh, she sounds amazing. I don't suppose there's any chance I could meet her, is there?"
"Oh," she says. "No, I'm afraid not. She's in meetings all afternoon."
"I understand. My brother's a head teacher too, at a school out in Upfield Common. He's always so busy."
"Upfield Common?" says the young woman.
"Yes, Surrey Hills. Do you know it?"
"Well, no, not really. But I'm pretty sure that's where Jacinta used to be before she came here. What's the name of the school?"
"It's called Maypole House, I think." The young woman claps her hands together and says,
"Yes, Maypole House. That's where she used to teach. Well, what a coincidence. And you said your brother works there?"
"Yes, he just started there. Wow, well, that really is a coincidence." Sophie has no idea where she is going with her subterfuge, but at the very moment that her unplanned narrative starts to unravel in her head, the young woman glances keenly over her shoulder, gets halfway to her feet and calls out,
"Oh, Jacinta!"
Sophie turns and sees a tiny woman striding across the entrance hall behind her in a black polo neck jumper and red tartan trousers. Her blonde hair is tied into a sculpted bunch at the base of her neck, and she's wearing incredibly high heels, in an obvious attempt to add height to her build. She smiles questioningly at the woman behind the desk.
"Alice," she says, "what can I do for you?"
"Sorry, I can see you're busy, but this lady was in asking for a prospectus for her stepdaughter, and we were chatting, and it turns out that her brother is the head teacher at your old place." Jacinta's eyes narrow, and she glances curiously at Sophie. She touches the chain around her neck and says,
"Old place? Sorry, what was your name? I'm afraid I didn't catch it."
"Susie," Sophie replies hastily.
"Susie Beats."
"Jacinta Croft." She offers her tiny porcelain hand.
"Lovely to meet you, Susie. And your brother's at Maypole House, you say?"
"Yes, he just started this term. But, oh my goodness, he's gone in at the deep end. Only a couple of days into term and the police are already all over the school, apparently." She watches Jacinta's reaction closely and sees her eyelids twitch, a muscle spasm slightly under her cheekbone.
"Really?"
she says, guiding Sophie gently away from the desk and into an alcove lined with wooden panels carved with the names of former head girls.
"Yes,"
Sophie continues disingenuously. "Apparently some children went missing near the school last year, and now it looks like they've found some new evidence in the grounds. I mean, actually, if you were there last year, maybe you know about it." She drops this last humdinger of a question with wide eyes. She is channeling Susie Beats so entirely that there is barely any iota of Sophie left. Jacinta's small boned face twitches again.
"The teenage couple, you mean?"
"Yes," Sophie replies. "I think that's right. My brother didn't really tell me that much.
They were very young. They had a baby. It was horrible."
She shakes her head.
"They never found a trace of them, as far as I'm aware. But God, the rumours afterwards."
She shakes her head again and puts a hand to her neck.
"So much gossip. So many conspiracy theories. Because unfortunately, and I don't know if your brother is aware of this, but the girl whose house the couple had been at before they went missing was a former pupil at Maypole House. And they were with another former pupil of the school, plus a teaching assistant and the matron's daughter. So it all got very messy for a while. From the school's point of view, even though none of those children was under our care at the time, it was one of the things that made me want to leave." She sighs. "Your poor brother having it all raked up all over again. What was it they found exactly?"
"Oh," Sophie says. "Something in the woods just behind the cottage," he said. "A ring?"
"A ring?" Jacinta arches an eyebrow. "How strange. I thought you were going to say..."
She stops. Sophie looks at her questioningly.
"Nothing," she continues. "I'm just not sure why a ring would bring the whole case back up to the surface."
Her eyes go to the clock on the wall behind Sophie.
"I'm really sorry," she says. "I do have to go. But please wish your brother all the luck in the world with a new job."
Sophie smiles and thanks Jacinta again. Then she turns to leave and waves at the girl called Alice at the desk. As she heads towards the sliding door, Alice calls out,
"Mrs. Beats, don't forget your prospectus for Pixie."
Sophie turns back and takes the shiny brochure from the woman's hand.
"Thank you,"
she says brightly.
"I can't believe I nearly forgot."
Sophie breathes out hard as she turns the corner and heads back onto Vauxhall Bridge Road. She finds a recycling bin and tosses the prospectus into it. Then she looks at the time and realises it is still early and that she is in no hurry whatsoever to head back to Upfield Common. So she texts her friend Molly, who works in Victoria, and asks if she's free for lunch. Molly replies immediately that she is. as she slides into the soft leather bonquette of the buzzy, pistachio-hued brasserie a few minutes later. She feels it all start to fall away from her. The remoteness of her existence. The silence at night under the sloped ceiling of their bedroom in the cottage by the woods. The little rose bush behind the bus stop. The sad face of Kim Knox polishing glasses behind the bar at the Swan and Ducks. Sean's brittleness. The preciseness of his necktie. The smile she hasn't seen for days. Suddenly, it is as if she never left. As if none of it exists. It is just she and Molly, a glass of wine, and three businessmen across the way eyeing them hungrily. And it almost comes to a shock to Sophie, when the lunch comes to an end, that she is not to return to her flat in Deptford. That she is instead to get on a lumbering, creaking train out of Victoria and sit on it for 45 minutes, watching London fade into the distance. You know, she says to Molly as they pull on their jackets and prepare to leave, I miss London so much. The grass is always greener, says Molly. I'd give anything to go and live in the country, with a handsome head teacher and no rent. Sophie smiles a tight smile. I know, she says. I know, I just feel a bit lost. You'll find your way, says Molly. It's not even been 2 weeks. You'll find your feet. You're such a flexible person, Soph. You always have been. It's nearly 2:30 by the time Sophie and Molly part ways outside the restaurant. For a moment, Sophie stands on the spot, her feet strangely glued in place. She looks across the street at the dark shape of Victoria Station. She doesn't feel ready to head back. Not yet. She takes the tube to Oxford Circus and spends an hour trawling up and down its infuriating pavements full of people walking either too slowly or too fast. She wanders blindly around a branch of Zara, a branch of Gap. She goes in one side of Selfridges and out the other without really looking at anything. Her head churns with everything and nothing. She doesn't want to go back to Upfield Common, and the thought chills her. She keeps walking and she keeps walking. She sits in a Starbucks and drinks strong tea from a paper cup. She looks at books in bookshops, checks the spines in the fiction D to F section, finds only one copy of a PJ Fox book and sighs. No wonder she doesn't sell if the shops don't stock any. She spirals through the huge Primark at Marble Arch and comes out with 3 pairs of lacy pants for £7. It's 4:30. She still doesn't want to go home. Her thoughts go back to Jacinta Croft as she threads through Mayfair's back streets and onto Park Lane. She'd stopped, hadn't she, at one point during their conversation? Stopped at the moment that Sophie had told her about the ring. What was it she'd said? Something to do with expecting there would be something else dug up in the woods. Sophie finds the number for Jacinta's school on Google and calls it. To her surprise, she is put straight through, and a moment later, Jacinta's warm but professional voice is greeting her. I had a feeling I'd be hearing from you again, she says. Chapter 32, September 2018. Kim's phone rings. She picks it up from where it is balanced on the edge of the kitchen sink and sees the name Megs. At first, she thinks, why on earth is Megs calling me? And then she remembers. She hits the answer button and says hello. Kim, it's Megs. Yes, she says. I assume you've spoken to Dom.
Yes, he called yesterday. What's going on?
He told you about the ring?
Yes, he told me about the ring. He told me they'd search those blessed woods yet again. And that's about it. Any more developments?
Kim sighs. Nothing. They've talked to Liam again. They've talked to Kerry Ann's girl. And they've got a handwriting analyst looking at the writing on the sign that was next to the ring.
Fingerprints, says Megs.
On the ring. Have they found any?
The police have it. I'm sure they'll be looking for prints, but the woman who found it, she had to clean the box to find the name of the jeweller, so it's unlikely any prints will still be on it.
Megs murmurs down the phone. Then she says, Anyway, how are you?
Kim starts slightly. She was not expecting any small talk.
I'm okay, you know. A bit freaked out.
Yeah, says Megs. It's a bit weird, isn't it?
There's a pause which Kim leaves empty, deliberately to give Megs the opportunity to ask after her grandson. But she doesn't.
Anyway, Megs says instead, keep me posted. I can't believe that we might finally find out what actually happened.
Me neither, says Kim. Then, sensing a hint of softness in Meg's tone, she says, how are you doing? Are you coping okay? She hears Meg's draw in her breath.
No,
she says eventually.
No, not really. But it is what it is, isn't it? You just have to pull on your big girl pants and get on with it.
Have you had any thoughts? Asks Kim. Any theories about what happened? Because you always thought they'd just run away together, didn't you? She asks this question gently, as if it is a tiny egg that she doesn't want to crack.
Well, yes, I did think that. And to be honest, part of me still does. It's the only thing that makes any sense, really.
I can see that, Kim continues carefully. I can see that some people might think that a mother and father would just abandon their son in order to walk off into the sunset together, and yes, I agree, it could happen. Some people might do that. But Tallulah wouldn't. And neither would Zack. He worshipped Noah. He was going to propose to Tallulah. He was saving up for a deposit on a flat for the three of them. So, I know, Megs, that it's easier to think of them living somewhere happily together, not wanting to be found, but that doesn't mean it makes any sense. Because it really doesn't.
I do sometimes wonder.
Megs begins, then stops.
I don't know, she says. Did you ever wonder if the baby was really Zack's?
Kim feels something crash inside her head. She says nothing because she can't find any words.
I mean, it's just a theory. But it might explain it.
Explain what?
You know, whatever it was that happened that night. Maybe Zack found out he wasn't a father and there was a fight. Maybe he was just so humiliated that he stormed off, too ashamed to come home. And maybe something happened to Tallulah out there in the dark. Or maybe she couldn't face the shame of it either, you know.
Kim opens her mouth to say something and then closes it again. Megs continues.
Because I never really thought that Noah looked much like Zack. And usually babies look like their dads, don't they? And Noah, he just never did. I never felt that sense of connection with him like I have with my other grandbabies.
Kim stabs the screen of her phone with her finger to end the call and drops it onto the kitchen counter as though it is burning her. She rocks backwards slightly against the edge of the kitchen counter. There, she thinks. There it is. Finally. Megs doesn't believe Noah is Zack's son. She thinks that Tallulah slept with another boy and got pregnant and then pretended to Zack that the baby was his so that he would look after them. Even though Zack virtually had to beg for 6 months to be allowed to be part of the family. And not only that, but Megs thinks that somehow Zack's disappearance and Tallulah's were separate events. That poor emasculated, cuckolded Zack walked off, leaving Tallulah either to be murdered in the dark or to run away from her child in shame. Kim looks around her kitchen. She sees the ghosts of moments that have now passed into unimaginable history. Tiny Noah in his high chair, his cheeks high with colour, thumping his fist against the tray with the joy of discovering that he could blow a raspberry. Tallulah filming him on her phone and laughing so hard her eyes streamed. The pure white-hot love that connected the three of them, the way it filled Kim's tiny kitchen to the furthest corners of the room. And now Tallulah is gone. And Noah is a trying, screen-obsessed two-year-old who spends his days either away from home at nursery or here pushing Kim's buttons as hard as he possibly can, who blows raspberries not because he can, but because he wants to express his disgust with the world that Kim has carved for him out of what was left over when his mother disappeared in the night. And Kim is so alone, and her world feels so small, and she wants it all back, all of it. She drops her head into her chest, and she weeps until she runs out of tears. Chapter 33, March 2017. Scarlett returns to Manton College at the beginning of March. Tallulah watches her mother dropping her off in a black Tesla, sees the suggestion in the driver's seat of black sunglasses on top of dark, shiny hair, gems glinting on clawed fingers gripping a leather steering wheel, and then the unmistakable outline of Scarlett emerging from the passenger seat, her hood up, her shoulders slumped. The door slams, the Tesla pulls away, and Scarlett's eyes meet Tallulah's.
Hello, you.
Tallulah feels her stomach churn at the sight of her. It's been 10 days since their sleepover, and she's been avoiding Scarlett's calls, her text messages, her Snapchats, her voicemails, the slightly unhinged sequences of GIFs of people dancing, begging, kissing, jumping, spinning, hugging, that make no sense whatsoever. She's ignored the sad face selfies, the photos of Toby, the dog, accompanied by the words, "Where do go, nice human?" She keeps her phone on silent at all times so that Zach doesn't wonder what on earth is going on. She begins.
Hi.
It's my mum, Scarlett begins. She said if I didn't come back, she was going to send me to live with my grandma. So she made a call and here I am. Tallulah shuffles slightly on the spot. It's a bitterly cold morning and there are spots of freezing rain in the air that sting where they hit the skin on the backs of her hands. She shoves them into the pockets of her coat and says,
"Sorry I didn't reply to anything."
Scarlett shrugs but doesn't respond.
"It's Zach. You know, he's always there."
"You could have come on Sunday, when he does his football." Scarlett sounds brittle, less of her usual bluster and volume.
"He's still cross about Friday night."
Tallulah hates the sound of the words on her lips. They make her sound so pathetic.
"Who cares?"
Scarlett responds. "Who cares what Zach thinks? You're 18, Tallulah. You're not an old married woman. Just tell him you don't care. Tell him to fuck himself."
"I can't."
"Why not? What do you think would happen?"
"Nothing,"
she says, thinking of the feel of his fists around her wrists, the way he tugs on her hair, just a little too hard sometimes.
"Nothing."
They walk together towards the college grounds, and for a while they are silent. Then Scarlett says, "So, what's the deal with you and me?" Tallulah glances around, making sure that they are not within earshot of anyone.
"I don't know,
She stops and turns to face Scarlett and talks to her in a hushed whisper.
"I don't know how I feel about it. I don't know what to think."
"Well, running away from it isn't going to help you work it out."
"I know, I need time. It's all new to me."
Scarlett's face softens. "I was lying about my mum, by the way. She didn't make me come back to college. I asked to come back." Tallulah looks at her curiously.
"I just thought this way we could hang out. Without, you know, Zach the ball sack telling you what you can and can't do."
Tallulah stifles a laugh. "Zach the ball sack." Then she says more seriously,
"I have to go now. I'm already late. I'll see you at lunchtime then, maybe in the canteen, yeah?"
Tallulah feels the resolve she spent the past week building up start to crack and crumble under Scarlett's bright-eyed assumption that they are going to meet for lunch, that they are going to become something.
"Scarlett," she says as Scarlett turns to go.
"Yes?"
Tallulah lowers her voice to a whisper.
"This,"
she says, gesturing between the two of them with a hand.
"This is secret, yes? Just us. Nobody else."
Scarlett nods and puts two fingers to her cheek, side by side.
"Scout's honour,"
she whispers.
"You and me, nobody else."
Then she moves the fingers down to her mouth and kisses them, before turning them towards Tallulah and blowing on them. She mouths the words, "See you later," and goes. For the next few weeks, Tallulah and Scarlett develop a routine of sorts. On Mondays, Scarlett's mum brings her into college on her way to her yoga class at the leisure centre, and she and Tallulah meet outside college and walk in together. On Wednesdays and Thursdays, Scarlett meets Tallulah at the bus stop in Upfield Common, and they take the back seat, and they talk, and they talk, and they talk. At lunchtime, sometimes they sit in the canteen, where Tallulah plays the role of Scarlett's quiet new friend. The others, Mimi, Rue, Jaden, and Rocky, talk over her and act as if she isn't there. She doesn't blame them, as she is trying so very hard not to be noticed or thought of in any way as significant in Scarlett's life. On Monday afternoons, when Tallulah and Scarlett both finish early and Zach works late, they meet on the corner of the next road down after classes and go to the funny little tea shop on the high street where all the old ladies go but none of the kids from college, and they order slices of homemade carrot cake and mugs of tea, and they sit in a booth right at the back where they can stare into each other's eyes and fiddle with each other's hands and grab each other's legs underneath the table, and no one can see, and even if they could see, they wouldn't have anyone to share it with because nobody in the tea shop knows who they are. And then on Sundays, while Zach is at football and Scarlett's mum is at the leisure centre in Manton meeting a friend to go swimming, Tallulah borrows her mum's bike and cycles through the country lanes with her heart full of anticipation and nerves and excitement and glee. And Scarlett meets her at the door of Dark Place, and they stumble upwards, quickly, hotly, madly, to Scarlett's bedroom and fall onto her bed. And Tallulah feels all the things that anchor her down all week long melt away into the golden places where they meet in the middle. They say things into each other's ears with warm breath and soft lips. They fold themselves together and they block out the world with each other. And afterwards, Tallulah doesn't want to shower, doesn't want to wash the beautiful stain of Scarlett's touch off her flesh. So she goes home to her boyfriend and her baby, still smelling of Scarlett's mouth, Scarlett's bedding, Scarlett's old-fashioned French perfume that her aunt gives her every year for her birthday because she once told her she liked it when she was 5 years old. And nobody notices. Not even Zach, who now accepts Tallulah's new hobby, her Sunday morning cycle around the country lanes to get fit, to help lose her baby belly. He thinks what he can smell is the smell of Tallulah's exercise. He thinks the flush in her cheeks is down to country air. Tallulah can feel herself begin to blossom and grow during these weeks, as winter turns to spring. Her life now brings her two sources of joy, her baby boy, her secret girlfriend. The days grow longer, the nights grow warmer. Noah gets bigger, learns how to hug. Scarlett dyes her hair lilac and has Tallulah's initials tattooed on the side of her foot. TM. If anyone asks, she says, I'll say it stands for trademark. But Zach is still in Tallulah's life, and Zach is not a source of joy. He's working extra hours at the builder's depot, desperate to grow a nest egg of money so that they can get their own place together. He has a spreadsheet and demands that Tallulah sit down every evening to look at it with him. Look, he says, pointing at figures, scrolling up and down. If I can get the promotion to assistant aisle manager next month, that'd be an extra 68 a week, plus overtime, plus my mum says she can lend us a couple of thousand. So I reckon by the summer, look, we'd have £13,559 in the bank. And obviously we'd end up in a shared ownership, most likely, but there are some really nice ones just outside Reigate. Look. And then he switches screens to a new tab where he has the details of some tiny boxy flats with no outside space for Noah, miles and miles away from here, from her mum, from Manton, from Scarlett. And Tallulah nods and makes a smile and says, they look really cute. And all the while she is thinking, no, 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 I do not want to live there with you. Instead, she is thinking of a world without Zach in it, trying to imagine the contours of that world, how smooth and perfect it would be just to exist for Noah and for Scarlett, not to have to exist for anyone else. At the beginning of April, when she is 19 years old and Zach is 19 years old, and they have had their joint party, a subdued affair at an American-themed restaurant in Manton. Just family, not friends. Saving money for the flat that Tallulah has no intention of ever moving into, for the life that she has no intention of ever living. Zach books a viewing at one of the flats on his shortlist for Saturday morning. He's buzzing with it all that morning as he showers and dresses. 19 years old, he says. 19 years old and about to buy his first property. Ha! Tallulah's mum drives them to the development, and they all peer through the windows at the half-built blocks of flats lined up alongside the A25. They are constructed from a kind of off-black brick, with areas of dark grey plastic cladding designed to look like wood. Each block is built around a courtyard lined with tiny saplings, encircled with wooden fencing, and new baby grass covered in netting. A woman in a glass office greets them effusively and expresses wonder at their young age, at the cuteness of Noah, and excitement at the concept of their very first home. She takes them to see three units. They're all icy cold and smell of paint and laminate glue, and their voices echo when they speak. One has views across the A25, the next has views across the central courtyard, and the last across the scrappy edges of Reigate suburbs. The kitchens are shiny and white, designed to emulate the huge glossy kitchens of rich people's mansions, but a tenth of the size. Around the bathtub, there are metro tiles in shiny dark grey to match the cladding on the outside of the building. It's all very smart. It's all very modern. It's all so very not what Tallulah wants. But her mum makes all sorts of positive noises, and a conversation buzzes around her head between Zach, the saleswoman, and her mum about the layouts, the potential, which would be Noah's room, what colour you could paint the walls, the local area, the new supermarket about to open in the retail development across the way. And Tallulah feels numb and scared that she is letting this happen to her. Angry that she is 19 years old and in love with Scarlett Jacques, but looking at flats in a cold block with a man she wishes was dead. In the car on the way home, she sits in the back and holds Noah's hand as he sleeps. In the front, Zach and her mother are chatting. After a moment, her mother turns to Tallulah and says, "What did you think, sweetie?"
"They were nice."
"Which one did you like best?"
"The one facing the courtyard,"
she replies dutifully, as she knows that's the one Zach likes the best, and it will draw the conversation away from her. In bed that night, in the warm, airless space between Noah's and Zach's sleeping bodies, Tallulah decides that when she sees Scarlett the next day, she is going to tell her about Noah. She is going to tell Scarlett that she is a mother, that she has had a baby, that the stretch marks Scarlett has run her fingertips over are not because she used to be fat, but because she once grew an 8-pound, 2-ounce baby inside her. And then she is going to ask her to stop being her secret girlfriend and be her real girlfriend. And she is going to tell her mother, and she is going to tell Zach, and she is going to stop her life veering off into this place of flats on A-roads and controlling boyfriends and secrets. She is going to own her destiny, own her identity. She is going to be true and real and honest, her best, most authentic and pure self. The following day, she watches Zach leave with his football kit bag over his shoulder from her bedroom window, and she throws her things into her bag, runs down to the kitchen, kisses Noah and her mother, grabs the bike from the side return, straps on her helmet and cycles as she never cycled before to Dark Place. But at the front door, she sees another bike leaning up against the place where she normally leaves hers. She glances around herself, but can see no sign of anyone. Maybe she thinks it's the gardener, maybe it's a cleaner, or someone come to skim leaves off their swimming pool. She rings the doorbell, her heart pattering under her ribcage with the exertion of cycling so fast, the anticipation of seeing Scarlett. And the door opens, and there is Scarlett, still in her pyjamas, her hair scraped back into a spiky bun. And there is a young man in jeans and an old-fashioned navy blue jumper with a high-zipped neck. Scarlett looks at Tallulah, and then at the man, and then she says, "Lules, this is Liam. Liam, this is Tallulah." Tallulah throws Scarlett a questioning look.